Good morning, everyone. That was nice. I got a response. This morning we have two main items for our agenda. The first two presentations prior to the break are going to relate to informed consent. And then after the break, we have the participant panel where participants will talk about their experiences as research participants, which will be certainly include some discussion of informed consent, but will be much broader than that. So that's after the break. Second thing is that we have a change in the schedule. Our speaker who's listed on your syllabus, John Aris, was unable to join us today. So we have a wonderfully gracious substitute to talk with us about informed consent this morning. Now, I'll introduce Seema in 1 second. Before I do that, I want to remind everybody, as I always do, please sign in if you haven't signed in. And remember that if you want credits for this class, you need to fill in the form that says how many hours you've been here and hand it in before you leave. So to start us off on the very important topic of informed consent, Seema Shaw, who is an attorney who works in the Department of Bioethics with us, also works for the Henry Jackson Foundation and the Division of AIDS of the NIAID, and is a wonderful colleague and friend. Seema is going to talk about informed consent.
Hello, everyone. Let's see if you can hear me through the lavalier. Thanks for the introduction, Christine. And I wanted to say that as a substitute today, you'll find that I'm a little different from the speaker you were supposed to have. So not only would you find that I'm a little bit shorter and my hair is less gray, but it's also true that I'll talk about the law a little bit more, give you some introduction to some of the cases that set up how we think of informed consent today. And then I'll also give you a preview for my talk next week and discuss some international issues in relation to informed consent. So first, let me just express that these are my opinions and not the opinions of the government or the Henry Jackson Foundation. And what I'll do is start out with some background. Mostly I'll focus on the law of informed consent and how it's developed to what we have today. Next, I'll lead you through the elements of informed consent. And finally, I'll focus on the question of individual versus community informed consent, which is a debate that's gone on a little bit in the literature. So informed consent is something we obtain because we want to show respect for individual autonomy, because we want to allow people to decide for themselves whether to enroll in clinical research. But it's also true that informed consent serves an important function. It allows people to protect their own interests and what matters to them. So if, for instance, you had a research subject who had very particular interests that the researcher might know, the fact that certain risks are disclosed to that subject gives the subject an opportunity to protect his interests. Let's say you had a drummer who wanted to enroll in research, and one of the side effects of the research drug was that there might be some loss of motor control. Well, to that drummer, even if that risk was fairly slight, you might think that that's a fairly important risk, and he would know to protect his own interests if that information was given to him in a way that the researcher would not. So informed consent serves multiple functions, but this is one of the most important. How important is informed consent, though, in the scheme of things? Well, it's true that informed consent is an important condition, but it may not be necessary in all cases. For instance, emergency research is something that we think is important. If people are going to be given care in emergency situations, it's critical to think through what the best type of care is that they might receive. So we have to do some form of research on the way that we deliver emergency care. But one of the problems is typically when people come in for emergency care, they're in a situation where they may be in such a state that they need care immediately, and they can't delay that care for the opportunity to give consent. And it may also be true that they're unconscious, and so there's no way for them to give consent at that time. Nevertheless, we think emergency research is important, and the federal regulations actually provide for emergency research to be conducted without consent, with some additional protections, including getting advanced input from the community of people like the patients who would be involved in the research. It's also true that simply obtaining a subject's informed consent will not make the research ethical. Informed consent is one condition among many, which you've heard about through this course. So the first time informed consent was mentioned that we think about was in 1767 in a British lawsuit. And this case was the case of Slater versus Baker and Stapleton. Baker and Stapleton were two physicians, and they were held liable for re-breaking a bone because the court found that it appears from the evidence of surgeons that it was improper to disunite the callus to break the bone without consent. This is the usage and law of surgeons. And one of the interesting things about this quote is it's not that the court is setting out a new legal standard or that the court is imposing its own views on what it was that surgeons did. Instead, the court looks to what surgeons do and notices that their law and their usage required consent. So what this suggests is that consent actually predates this mention and has been an important part of medicine for quite some time. Arguments for the importance of consent in research actually occurred before 1900. So in 1892, Coley injected patients with cancer to induce artificial erysipelas. He describes how he began treatment with a patient who had a sarcoma, and only after some deliberation did this patient consent, and injections began. One of the most famous quotes about informed consent came from Justice Cardozo in the case of Schoellendorf, which I've never known how to pronounce, versus the Society of New York Hospitals. And what he said was that every human being of adult years and sound mind has a right to determine what shall be done with his own body. What's interesting, though, is that this law actually developed from tort law, prohibiting battery or non-consensual touching. So the idea behind battery is that any time two people interact and one person touches the other, that's an action that has to happen with prior consent. And you may ask yourselves, let's say you came over here through the metro and you bumped up against someone in the metro and they didn't cry, battery, I'm going to sue you. Well, the reason is that there are a lot of interactions that we have in day-to-day life where there's actually implied consent for some form of touching. It's generally accepted that when you get on a crowded metro that you might bump into somebody else. But in general, the law presumes that we have given consent for those kinds of touching. Other kinds of touching, like when a physician touches your body or when a surgeon cuts into your skin, those kinds of touching would be considered battery without prior consent. So in that's the way that consent law has developed, which is a little strange. It's not the way we usually think of informed consent. Typically, people talk about informed consent as if it was an agreement between a researcher and a subject. And they often, I think about it as a contract. But contract law is very different from the law of battery. And I think some of the ways in which informed consent developed lead to the way we think about it now. And it may be that battery was the wrong or maybe not the exactly appropriate way to begin, but that's what we have with our law. In 1946 to 1949, the Nuremberg trial occurred, and the formulation of the Nuremberg Code was one of the most lasting legacies of that trial. The Nuremberg Code contains certain basic principles that must be observed in order to satisfy moral, ethical, and legal concepts. And the first and longest principle is that the voluntary consent of the human subject is absolutely essential. Well, there are some limitations of this code. Although it did important work and looked back again to what German physicians had done and what the ethical codes had been in Germany before the war, it's also the case that informed consent would not have made the Nazi experiments ethical. To put it mildly, the risk-benefit ratio of the trials that were conducted were inappropriate. So it doesn't matter that informed consent didn't happen in those trials as much as it matters that the trials themselves were things that never should have happened. But it's also true that it is generally considered ethical to do research on people who cannot consent in some cases. So this principle has important exceptions. One exception is pediatric research. We typically think children can't give consent. But we also think it's important to do research on children to gain information that will help them, to ensure that we know what the right dosage is for children who are very different from adults. What's interesting about this is in Ethiopia, actually, there is a law prohibiting biomedical research on children. But in most countries in the world, biomedical research on children is allowed. Adults who cannot consent are another population where we think sometimes it's important to conduct research, even though these adults cannot give consent. In terms of research and informed consent, one of the earlier cases I could find that dealt with this and set out how research and informed consent interact was in 1976. This is Ahern versus the Veterans Administration. And what the court found was that in order for a physician to avoid liability by engaging in drastic or experimental treatment, which exceeds the bounds of established medical standards, his patient must always be fully informed of the experimental nature of the treatment and the foreseeable consequences of that treatment. So that gives you a sense of what the legal background is for informed consent. What's happened is that we now think of informed consent as divided up into the various elements. So valid informed consent requires the capacity to make autonomous decisions, disclosure of relevant information, understanding of that information, voluntariness of the subsequent decision, and some indication or authorization that consent was given. So I'll go through each of these elements in turn. A person with capacity has the ability to consider the various options that are proposed to them and decide which option fits best with that individual's values and interests. Who has capacity to give consent in research is determined by state law about who can give consent to the medical procedures, which is an interesting feature. So the federal regulations actually leave the question of capacity open to state law, and it varies by state. With regard to children, which I think is one of the more interesting issues within the question of capacity, in most states of the United States, children become capable to give consent at 18 with some exceptions. There is one state in which children become capable at the age of 19. One exception is that for the treatment of sexually transmitted infections or for drug use, there are exceptions in certain states where children can give consent as young as 14. And the idea is that children who need this type of treatment, maybe children who are doing things where their parents may not approve of what they're doing. And so in order for them to get the treatment they need, you might need to contact the children themselves and give them the treatment they need. The other issue is that mature minors exist. So certain states will designate that when a minor becomes pregnant and gives birth to a child, or when a minor marries, at that point, the minor then has the capacity to act as an adult to give consent for future procedures and more things in life. These exceptions aside, consent generally should be obtained from parents, and the federal regulations also lay out that provisions should be made for obtaining assent from children. And the age at which children become adults in other countries ranges quite a bit. So in some countries, the age is actually 14. In other countries, the age is 21, and there are a variety in the middle. Adults with mental disorders or brain damage may also lack capacity for informed consent, and the federal regulations provide for some consent to be obtained in this situation, proxy consent, which would be obtained from a subject's legally authorized representative. And this can come about by a subject, when they are competent, designating someone to act as their decision maker through an advance directive. It can also be the case that a court will designate someone to act as the legally authorized representative for a subject. So the next element of informed consent is disclosure. And here, in order to respect an individual's autonomy, the idea is that the information that a person needs to make a decision should be disclosed to them. Disclosure also serves an important institutional function. If an institution has disclosed certain risks, then there is evidence for subsequent litigation. So I think one of the other driving features behind disclosure is this concern about future litigation. And that explains some of what we see and some of what Christine Grady will talk about later with respect to how long informed consent documents are. So what information is it that should be disclosed? Well, one of the complicating features is that even the most basic research protocol involves more information than any one of us could ever understand. There's a lot of background scientific information about the research that's happened before this research was conducted, for instance, some of which may be relevant and important for subjects to understand, but some of which may be too complex for them to understand. And we simply can't disclose everything. So how do we decide what to disclose? Well, there are different legal standards that have been proposed, and this is true both in medical care and in research. The first standard is professional. What information is it that researchers usually provide? The second standard is a reasonable person standard. So what information would a reasonable person in the same situation want. And the final standard is an individual standard. What information would this individual sitting in front of the researcher want? So Canterbury versus Spence is a case where the court discussed these various standards and pointed out some of the deficiencies in some of the standards and also some of the positive attributes of them. So the first standard, the professional standard, they refer to as reliance on the custom of physicians. And the court pointed out that if you were to rely simply on what other physicians or what other researchers did, you could run into a situation where physicians would generate a code of silence. So in order to figure out what the standard was, you would have to have physician testimony in a particular case where physicians would explain what the standard was. And if physicians wanted to protect each other, all they'd have to do is testify that the standard was what the physician in the case at bar did. So the court was concerned about this possible outcome. And the court also noted that this standard wouldn't really respect the autonomy, the patient's right of self-determination. The next standard is a reasonable person standard, and the court found that this standard does respect patient autonomy. But one of the counterarguments that physicians raised was there may be cases in which patients don't actually want the information. So if they obtain the information, they might become distraught. So if you rely on this reasonable person standard, you may run into situations where you're giving someone information that actually bothers them or causes them distress, and it doesn't respect that particular person's autonomy. Well, the court said that this was an important point, but that what they didn't want was that a particular patient would have to prove in each case that they would have wanted this information. To make a claim like this, the court said that the burden of proof was going to be on physicians to establish that this particular patient would indeed have become distraught. Finally, the court noted that the individual standard is a difficult standard to apply in practice because you can't determine what the standard is after the fact except by asking the patient, what is it that you would have wanted to know? And the difficulty here is that if you have someone who suffered a particular injury from research, and that person said, well, I really would have wanted to know about the thing that led to this injury, that is somewhat unreliable information. As we all know, hindsight is 20/20. So, and the court was very concerned that patients could manipulate the standard if it was to be applied in practice. So the court actually decided that the reasonable person standard was the best standard to apply in that case. It turns out, however, that states are almost evenly split between the professional and reasonable person standards as of 2006. I haven't checked to see how the trends have changed since then. And what we do know is that courts started out with the professional standard, but as the importance of patient autonomy has become realized a little bit more, states have moved in the direction of adopting the reasonable person standard. I think that the reasonable person standard does respect patient autonomy better than the professional standard, and it's also more practical than the individual patient standard. So I think there will be more movement in this direction. But it is the case now that courts still are evenly split, so it depends on what state you're in, which standard applies to you. So now that we know how we determine what should be disclosed, what is it that the federal regulations say should be disclosed to people who are involved in research? First, a statement that what they're doing is research is the first and most important thing, I think, that needs to be disclosed in the context of an informed consent form. Next, the purpose and procedures of the study should be disclosed. So this includes how many study visits a particular research subject will have to undergo and randomization if it is to occur. The risks and benefits must also be disclosed, including the benefits to others, the extent to which the researchers can protect confidentiality, that the subject has a right to withdraw, what the available alternatives are, and interestingly, what will happen if there is research-related injury must be disclosed to the research subject. What's interesting about this is that the federal regulations do not say that researchers or sponsors have to make any provision to deal with research-related injury if it happens. But if they don't have any plans to provide care or to do anything in the event of research-related injury, all they have to do is make sure they say that in the informed consent document. Finally, there has to be a name and number for who to contact for answers to questions about the research. So there are some legal limitations on disclosure. Informed consent documents are not allowed to include a waiver of any subject rights or any form of release to allow the researcher or sponsor to commit liability for negligence without any check through the courts. And one thing to point out is informed consent documents are different from contracts in this respect. Contracts can include waivers of liability, but informed consent documents cannot. There are many criticisms of current disclosure practices that you all may be very familiar with. People often say that consent forms are written at such a high level that it's difficult for subjects to understand them, and Christine will talk about this some more. And if a consent form has too much information, it will be hard for people to focus on the information that they actually need. So people do not make decisions by considering everything they know all at once. Instead, what it is they do is they choose between the available options. So it may help to focus informed consent documents on how research participation is different from the available options. For instance, if there is a research biopsy that is not part of clinical care, then it may be important to concentrate the discussion on that rather than the risks of clinically indicated medications that the patient would receive otherwise. So I think a lot of these criticisms relate to the fact that informed consent also serves as a function of protecting institutions. And informed consent documents are things that IRBs and lawyers look over. And when they do, many of the things that occur to them is if you include as many risks as possible, if you have everything down in writing, then you've protected yourself from future legal liability for not disclosing that information. One of the difficulties is that this is in tension with the desire to inform the subject in a way that the subject can actually understand what's going on. So I think this is one of the major criticisms of informed consent that people are trying to deal with, but that leads us to a situation that's less than ideal. When is it that, now that we've gone through what disclosure is, when is it unnecessary? Well, the federal regulations recognize that informed consent and disclosure of all of these things isn't necessary in all cases and permits waiver when the research involves minimal risk, when waiver will not adversely affect the subject's rights, when the research cannot practicably be carried out otherwise, and when subjects should get additional information after participation when it's appropriate. So next we'll talk about understanding. Understanding is the idea that you should process the disclosed information and determine how it applies to you. Before a person can make an informed choice, they have to understand the relevant information. But it's important to distinguish understanding from recall. It's not simply that if you describe the risks to a patient or a subject, and that subject is then able to respond by parroting those risks back to you, that subject necessarily understands what the research will involve. And it's also true that appreciation may be something slightly different from understanding. So there are two steps that are important to think through, but I'll focus on understanding here. The first is the ability to actually know what the risks are, to understand what they mean. And the second is the ability to appreciate that this means that you, yourself, are subject to these risks and that this might affect your life in particular ways. One of the difficulties about understanding is ensuring understanding in low literacy populations. So there are many contexts in the U.S. or internationally where potential subjects may not be able to read the informed consent document. And the way that IRBs typically deal with this is for populations that speak languages other than English, they use translations and then back translations for informed consent forms. What's interesting about this is that I think it doesn't necessarily do the job we want it to. So translations, translating something from one language into another is typically difficult around the use of idioms. One of the ways in which we try to describe randomization is we describe randomization in the U.S. as what happens when you flip a coin. You determine who gets what treatment by flipping a coin. The important point that's being distinguished is that it's not that subjects get the treatment that's best for them as decided by their physicians, but that it's allocated randomly. But in other contexts, the idea of flipping a coin doesn't have the same meaning it does for us. So what some people do in certain parts of sub-Saharan Africa is they'll talk about the idea of drawing colored beans from a bag, and that's the way that they talk about randomization. So I think one of the difficulties about using back translations is that there are many cases in which there aren't very good translations for particular words or where idioms don't translate at all. And what would work better is to make sure that there's someone who knows about the research and knows about the local language who's able to understand whether this makes sense for subjects. For research subjects who are not literate, however, researchers need to think about creative ways of disseminating information. So one of the changes that's happened lately is that there's an increasing use of decision aids in medicine, which are either web or device-based. So people are often given a website where they can go to find out information about the research, to go through a series of questions that they can take home and look at later. There are some devices, some PDAs that are given to people to go through the various aspects of the research. So informed consent may increasingly take on this character here in the U.S. But one of the more creative approaches I've heard about happened in Rakai, Uganda. There, what the researchers did was they actually decided to take the subjects and give them tours of the laboratory. So they said they took the subjects up to the centrifuge and showed them the machine that would be used to take vials of their blood. So they explained why they needed those vials by saying that if they took those vials and put them in the machine and spun it around, they could separate out the components of the blood and use the ones they needed for the research. And I think that gives subjects a picture of what's going to happen and a better understanding, especially if they've never been inside of a laboratory before. Another approach they took was they communicated through theater. So they actually put on a play that explained what research participation would involve and tried to educate people in that way about the choice that they were making. So finally, I'll talk about voluntariness. When a person makes a free choice that is not forced upon them, that's when a person makes a voluntary decision. And the important parts that come up in the research ethics literature is that this decision is something that's free from coercion and free from undue influence. One confusion I think that happens a lot is people think that an offer to participate in research is something that can be coercive. However, an offer is a proposal to make people better off. An offer to do something, therefore, is not coercive. What is required for coercion is that someone needs to threaten to make you worse off. And by contrast, what an offer does is give you more or better choices, and it makes you better off in that respect. It doesn't take away your choices, and it doesn't involve a threat. When could research participation, then, you might ask, be coercive? Well, a lot of times people raise this worry in situations that are inherently coercive. So in situations like prison settings, where wardens often may threaten prisoners with various sanctions for bad behavior. That might be a setting where you'd worry about coercion. But it's also the case that if the offer was not really an offer, you might have a coercive situation. One question that's actually arisen in ethics consults here is, what if a lab technician was asked by his boss to enroll in a research study that the boss was conducting? Well, in this case, we weren't actually worried about coercion, and it may be acceptable if it is truly an offer, although there may be additional protections you want to put on it. But the worry is that it would not be acceptable if the boss threatened the employee with her displeasure or with the possible termination of employment. So when there's a threat attached to the offer, it's not really an offer, and then you have to worry about coercion. Another way in which people talk about voluntariness and this concern is when research is conducted in resource-limited settings where people are in very bad situations. And they often say that the fact that someone's in a bad situation or is suffering from an illness is something that causes them to be coerced. But a bad situation does not coerce someone to do something. To be coerced, someone needs to threaten to make you worse off. In other words, unless there is a person or a moral agent who put you in that bad situation, the fact that you are in a bad situation is not coercive. So when a researcher interacts with somebody who's in a bad situation and makes them an offer, describing that offer as coercive because of the background conditions isn't right. It's not that the researcher is threatening the person, it's that they're in a bad situation already. People also think about the possibility that large payments for research participation might undermine voluntariness, and you'll hear more about undue inducement later in the course. But offering someone money to be enrolled in research, again, gives them more or better options, and therefore cannot be described as coercive. What it might be described as is something that causes undue influence. It may be that what happens is that large payments may confuse people and prevent them from making good decisions. So they may be so enticing or attractive that they affect a subject's capacity to carefully weigh the risks involved and to understand the research. Finally, the U.S. regulations require that a subject understand that he or she has the right to withdraw from research at any time. So this is, the U.S. regulations do put a premium on voluntariness, but they deal with it in this way. Now we'll talk about the indication of consent, or what's often referred to as authorization of consent. The U.S. regulations require that research subjects sign informed consent documents to authorize their participation in research. And this may seem like the simplest of all of the elements, but it too leads to some complications. The requirement for signature can only be waived when there is no other record of the subject's participation and there is a risk to the subjects regarding confidentiality, or in the situation that research is minimal risk and does not involve procedures for which you would need written consent if they were done outside of the research. So this might be something like survey research, where somebody implicitly answers your questions and gives you consent by continuing to answer your questions. In that case, you typically wouldn't ask for written consent on top of that consent. One of the difficulties with this is that some cultures have very different views of signatures. The view might be that once you have signed, your word is binding and you can no longer withdraw from research. But as I mentioned, the federal regulations require that subjects understand that they can withdraw from the research at any time. One interesting fact is that the Amish believe that verbal agreements are binding. So if you give somebody your word that you will participate in research or do a deal with them, if that person requires more, like a signature, that suggests that that person doesn't trust you, doesn't believe that your word is your bond. And this can be something that's a threat to somebody's dignity. The problem is the federal regulations are not all that flexible in this regard, and you probably cannot obtain waiver of this requirement for these concerns. In some populations, many individuals may not be able to sign informed consent documents. There are also individuals who have lost motor control and can no longer sign, which is something that comes up at the NIH. The signature in this case can be an X or a thumbprint. And one of the difficulties is that an X may not identify that the right person has signed the document. So what's often done is that some institutions have a witness document separately that the correct person made an X. And to understand more about the question of signatures, I've listed a paper, a citation there, that's very helpful. Finally, I'd like to talk about community versus individual consent. And this will give you a little bit of a taste of what I'll talk to you about again next week when I talk about international research ethics. So U.S. law requires that the consent of a competent adult research subject be obtained. But in some cultures, this focus on the individual may seem to neglect the importance of community. And when I've given this talk in other countries, sometimes what people have responded is they've said, well, I'm not sure what your culture is or if you have one, but in my culture, we have a very strong importance on the presence of the individual as ensconced in a community, as part of a group. And we don't think of people as very separated, very individual, very alone. So part of what's wrong with the way that the U.S. focuses on consent is that it neglects this consideration about the community and how we actually find people in our society. Although researchers must comply with applicable laws, and there's no way of getting around that, they should also attempt to respect cultural practices so far as they can. And I think the limitation on this is when these cultural practices are unethical. This obviously brings up concerns about cultural relativism, but I'll just leave that aside and assume that we can determine when cultural practices are unethical, because that's what I believe. Difficulties will also arise when cultural and language barriers intersect. So one thing that happens a lot is, especially here at NIH or at other places, traditionally people use the approach of having a family where one person didn't speak English and another person did. And what would often happen is that doctors or researchers would rely on the family member who spoke English to explain what the cultural practices were and also do the translating. People have moved away from this model for the reason that you're not necessarily going to get reliable information from the translator if you take that approach. And that person may not be translating everything accurately, may take over the decision-making for the person who cannot speak English. I think there's also this problem where researchers sometimes confuse the inability to speak English with the inability to understand complex research procedures. So that's one thing that used to happen more in medicine, but now people are recognizing that the use of an unrelated translator is very important, and it's also important to obtain cultural information from this translator or another expert. With regard to informed consent and culture, it's also true that conducting research in countries with different cultures may not even be possible without taking into account differing cultural norms. And one example of this happened in Mali. So researchers took approaches to obtain community consent by using a tiered model of consent. They decided to respond to the local views on consent by developing a different approach. This was an approach that took a stepwise process. So what the approach used is that the researchers first approached the leaders of the community. Then they conducted group discussions with the heads of extended families. Once they had done that, they had group discussions with the mothers of the children who would be involved in the study. And they finally obtained consent from individual families. What I thought was really interesting about this is they also approached the mothers-in-law of pregnant women before obtaining consent from the women themselves. And this was based on the idea that they were told that in Mali, pregnant women are very special, and the guardians of pregnant women are understood to be their mothers-in-law. But what I don't know is whether they asked the pregnant women whether they saw their mothers-in-law as their guardians and whether that's what they wanted. And I'm not sure how all of you would feel about that. Under this tiered consent model, I think one of the dangers about it is that it means that other people have veto power over an individual's decision about whether to enroll in research. And also, I think it's important to think that even though this model may work for a particular culture, it's important to not translate it too quickly to another culture. So the other culture that you're going to import the model to needs to be evaluated. And culture is not monolithic, as we all know. One culture may include many different ideas, may change over time, may include different subgroups or different subcultures. So it's tricky, I think, to determine whether you have the right model for the particular culture you're in. And there's no substitute for getting information from the individual and from other people in that culture to understand what it is that actually applies to the situation you're facing. One interesting solution is also to look to empirical data, if it's available, for the relevant community. So in a randomized study of anti-malarial treatments, 347 mothers in Uganda gave parental consent, and they were asked about the informed consent process. They overwhelmingly reported that they made the decision about enrolling their child on their own. They didn't consult their husbands, and they didn't consult their mothers-in-law. So what's interesting about this is that this data demonstrates that importing the model from Mali to Uganda wouldn't work, and you do need to look through the cultural norms of the place you're in. One thing that this has made me think is that we may need to think more about community consultation rather than community consent. Instead of giving individuals veto power over other individuals' decisions, it may be important to think through how do we involve the community in decision-making and in research. What's the appropriate way to ensure that there is input from the community and that we get the input from the context in which the individual is situated? Well, a model of community consultation might include community discussions about the study well in advance of enrolling subjects. And in the U.S., there are many advocacy groups for breast cancer and HIV, for instance, who are already involved in research. Most research that's conducted necessarily contacts people in those advocacy groups and consults with them before it happens because of the way that things have evolved. Another important element of community consultation is to engage with disenfranchised subgroups directly. So in a community in South Africa called Bulanlela, the researchers were trying to investigate how to prevent HIV. In this community, 30% of the young women under the age of 25 have HIV. And what they were trying to do was figure out how they could reach sex workers, who are very important people to reach in order to prevent the spread of the virus. They realized that you couldn't really reach these sex workers through usual channels, but they wanted to have some representation and some input from this group, knowing that they may be vulnerable and may have special concerns. So what they did is they went to where it was known that sex workers would be, and they asked them who was the leader of their community. Who was it who they all went to when they needed someone to talk to? And they all identified one woman who was the leader of that community. So that woman was represented on the community advisory board and gave input about the research. But as important as community consultation is, I think individual consent is also important for research participation to ensure that the individual's needs are not things that are overlooked for the community's concerns. There are also other benefits of community consultation. It enables further communication of information about the research. So one of the people who is a colleague of mine in the Department of Bioethics does research on Alaskan Native populations. And she said that when she was first planning to do this research, she was told not to describe it as research. She was told to use the word project. And she asked why, and they said there had been genetic research conducted on these populations before she got there. And the genetic research hadn't been very carefully done. So what happened was the findings were published and suggested a link between alcoholism and these particular populations. The community was very upset by how the findings were reported and what the consequences were for them. And they decided, what they interpreted from that, is that all research involved this type of carelessness about the community's concerns. But as she thought it through, what she decided to do was not to simply describe her research as a project, but to try and talk to the community and think through with them, explain to them what research meant, so that they would understand that not all research was like the research that had been conducted in the past, and that what she was doing was something designed to produce generalizable knowledge about the community, but with greater protections for the community. And I think that kind of discussion isn't something that you could do by having individual discussions of informed consent with subsequent people. It's a conversation that needs to happen on a different scale. Another advantage of community consultation is that it will include other stakeholders. So there may be other people in the community who are affected by the research but who aren't directly involved. It may also identify concerns that may not come up in individual discussion. It's often the case that there are people who are less able to express what their concerns are and other people who are more able to do it. So community consultation allows for concerns that may affect many to be brought up by those who are a little bit braver. And finally, it starts a dialogue with the community that can continue as the research progresses. So one of the best examples I've heard of this was also in the community of Vulanlela, where the community was involved in prevention research, and a similar trial was going on in Africa at the very same time. Results from that trial came out that were pretty damaging, and that particular intervention was found to carry certain risks that the researchers hadn't anticipated in this other trial at another site. So when that happened, the community actually contacted the researchers and said, "We know about this other trial. Can you explain to us how similar this trial is to the trial that we're in and how different it is? And explain to us what this information means for us." And I think this kind of dialogue is ideally the dialogue that all researchers would have with the communities with which they engage. So in conclusion, examining the history and elements of informed consent reveals that there are many important justifications for it. Obtaining individual informed consent becomes more complex, but no less important in international research. And what I've found that is surprising is that in some sense we've almost focused more on informed consent in international research than we have domestically. So there may be things, innovative efforts that have occurred internationally that can teach us something about how to improve informed consent in the U.S. As practiced, it's true that informed consent may overemphasize the protection of institutions over the protection of and the respect of human subjects. But although we need reform, informed consent has long been recognized as a critical component of medical care and medical research. And that, I think, is unlikely to change, nor should it. Thank you. Go ahead.
Your development of the history of informed consent is an admixture of back and forth examples from medical care or practice and then, you know, research. Even now we have protocols that are written here that are much like that, where there's clinical care embedded in a research protocol. So my question is this, since one line of informed consent is derived out of the criminal or battery law, and the standards for research are different, seem to be primarily federal law, and then you have this third idea that medical care is a contract, derivative of contract law. Suppose something goes wrong in these protocols. Mm-hmm. Is the investigator then tried in the state court in which the research occurred? And, for example, my understanding is conventional physician malpractice insurance doesn't cover you for lawsuits. Or a more recent example of international research was a bunch of European, predominantly French nurses and a physician arrested and tried in, I think it was Libya, for not conforming to Libyan law. So What's the liability to the researcher when one, you know, does admixtures of clinical care and research and two practices outside of the local community, for example, here drawing in patients from other states?
Well, that's a great question. As you know, the law is very confused, and there are a bunch of different types of law that could apply. So battery law is state law, and it's actually tort law. There is criminal battery, but that's a different sort of thing. That's related to assault. So the state tort law is where you would bring informed consent claims. There are also questions under the federal regulations, and if a government official is acting, then that would be a federal government official is acting, then that would be a federal suit that would be brought in federal court. So typically in the U.S., what happens, I think, is that many of these cases come up in federal court, and the state claims are brought into the federal suits. They're all tried together in the same place. Sometimes that doesn't work, and it goes back down to the state court, or other times people start in state court. One of the plaintiff's lawyer who's most active in this litigation, Alan Milstein, brings up a lot of constitutional claims as well, things about dignitary harm, things that actually haven't been recognized by any court. So he tends to operate in federal court. So that's where most of those lawsuits happen. You're right that there's this strange confluence of clinical care and that kind of law and research law, and I don't think that the courts have a very good way of dealing with all of that. So researchers are in a situation where there are many bodies of law that are being brought to bear on what they do, and those bodies of law can come into conflict or come from very different places. But I think the federal regulations provide the most clear guidance on what it is that researchers are required to do and how liability will arise, except in the international context. So there are cases where people have tried to sue researchers for research that has happened in various countries and bring lawsuit here in the U.S. Most of those cases have not succeeded, and those cases are very difficult to bring. I don't know very much about how that will happen in emerging places where people are applying the law of that country to the actions of the researchers there. They have to have the researchers or nurses or doctors in that place and be able to try them there. So that's one difficulty and one limitation that may prevent certain kinds of lawsuits from going forward. The Libyan case, I think, was fairly extraordinary because it was a use of law that was pretty much soundly rejected by international lawyers and other people who looked at how the legal claims were being brought. But I think that's one question that we'll see elucidated as time goes on, that we'll just have to see how it goes, and it will change depending on the country. Nathan?
It strikes me that amongst the things that were not included in the requirements for informed consent, disclosure of conflict of interest. And I'm particularly interested in a situation where you want industry-sponsored research where the researcher is being paid sometimes very handsomely for recruiting patients into studies. Is there an obligation to disclose this, or is this not considered an essential part of the informed consent process? And just as a follow-up question, is the NIH intrinsically coercive insofar as, you know, patients who come here are told you can get the best care possible if you're willing to go into research, but if you're not willing to go into a research protocol, you've got to go somewhere else?
Mm-hmm. Well, so for your first question, I think you may have a lecture on conflict of interest coming up. You had it already. Okay, so I guess if you don't know the answer now, it's up to me. So conflict of interest, I think, as you saw in the requirements from the federal regulations, it's not one of the things that's listed on the requirements of what you need to disclose. And there it becomes important to think through which standard applies and what that might mean as courts apply the standard. So you might think that reasonable people would want to know about a conflict of interest. There are some cases, there's some data to suggest that people actually don't care as much about how researchers are sponsored by pharmaceutical companies as we might think. So that data may suggest that the reasonable person might not be that concerned with what it is that should be disclosed, or it might be that all of those people aren't that reasonable and don't realize that they really should receive that information. So it's hard to say exactly how that would play out. From the professional standard, you might think that since most people may not disclose that information, maybe they're not, if a court was to apply that standard, they might find that there isn't an obligation to disclose that information. I do think that in many cases it makes sense to disclose that kind of information to subjects, that it may be relevant to what they need to know for research participation. So, and I think there's an increasing recognition of that. So courts might start to apply that in a particular way. With regard to your second question about whether NIH is inherently coercive, one of the things, although people do say NIH offers the best medical care in the world, some people say that anyway, maybe not all people. I think one of the important questions is there a threat to take away something that the person is otherwise entitled to? Could they get care in another place that would be comparable to what they would receive at the NIH? And also, if it's the case that they would get the best medical care if they stayed at NIH, to say that to somebody isn't untrue, isn't a problem. It doesn't make it coercive. It's just explaining to someone what the case is. So I think it depends on whether in that particular situation the care they're able to receive is in fact the most prompt and the best. If it's not, you know, there's a problem with sharing information that's untrue. And that may be a different sort of problem than a problem of coercion. Danielle?
So I was hoping you could elucidate the reasonable person standard a little more. So you say that states are almost evenly split between the professional standard and the reasonable person standard. And I agree with you that the reasonable person standard respects patient autonomy. But I'm not quite sure whether it's more practical than the individual patient standard. So I have some questions about how it's applied. First of all, how do the courts sort of ascertain what it is that the reasonable person would want? And when we're trying to figure out, say, as a physician or a researcher, what it is that I ought to disclose, it looks like the reasonable person standard could end up sort of becoming something like the individual patient standard, because either I apply this as some abstract kind of what the reasonable person up here as some abstract concept would kind of want, or I say, what is it reasonable for this individual to want to know? And then that starts to look quite like the individual patient standard. So I was just wondering about the practical problems of this standard.
Yeah, one interesting thing about the reasonable person standard is it's applied in different areas of law, and the courts sort of skirt over the issue of how do you determine who's reasonable? Is this really something that a court can do, and will this involve some degree of hindsight? But the way that the court distinguishes the reasonable person standard from the individual standard but still makes sure that it applies to the facts of the case is the idea is what the reasonable person would do in this context. So there has to be a somewhat rich description of what the particular features are of the choice that the individual was making. But it doesn't devolve into what is it that this individual person is concerned with and what are their very subjective features that only they can explain. So the court makes an attempt to apply the law to the very specific facts of the case before it, and in that way tries to get away from using an individual person standard that would be fairly subjective. I don't think it's a perfect process, and I'd be happy to talk with you more about it, but it is more of a, I think it's more of a workable standard than the individual patient standard, and it is distinct in the way that courts apply it. Last question.
Yes. It's sort of two parts, but they both go together. It seems to me that buried in your discussion, but you did say it, was that the informed consent document is really not designed to protect the researchers or the investigators. It's really designed to protect the patient. We use it to protect ourselves, but we really shouldn't be. We should be thinking of the patient or the subject. And research has shown that what the subject is most concerned about are the risks. All the rest of it is dressing, but that's where they really focus in terms of whether they want to do it or not. And I would like to know if you believe that the way the risks are presented in most informed consent documents satisfies the condition that the patient has been adequately protected against taking risks that they themselves would rather not take if they really understood them.
So that's a great question. I think partially one of the difficulties is that, you know, I don't mean to blame institutions or researchers for focusing on liability. I think in a very confusing legal scheme, it makes sense that people don't know how to protect themselves against liability and react in this defensive way that ends up generating a really enormous document that doesn't help people understand what research really involves. I do think that the way we talk about risks often doesn't help to protect the patient or to inform the patient. So typically you'll find them in the middle of a consent document, say on page 7 of 17. And when you get there, many of the risks that are discussed are the risks of the standard clinical interventions that somebody would get anyway. So they don't understand what the risks are of being involved in this research project specifically. Some of what people have tried to do is develop shortened informed consent forms, which is some of the work Christine has done, and to think through how do you place the risk information earlier and make it clearer to people. But I think one of the other elements that's also really important is distinguishing that this is research and not clinical care. That's something that many people are confused about, that they may not understand. So it seems to me that that's pretty much what should be first, and maybe risks should follow pretty shortly thereafter. Thank you all. I think I've taken a little more time than I should have.
Stand up and take a break. Don't go out of the room. Just stand up, take a deep breath, and we can clap for Seema one more time while you're standing, and then we'll continue. Okay, now you can sit down. I just want to add two things to what Seema said in thanking her for this lecture. For those of you who work intramurally, there is now a requirement to put a statement about conflict of interest in the consent form. And I think that the way they, at least in the United States, the way it's going is that it's an institution-by-institution decision about whether that happens. And I forget what the second thing was I was going to say, so I'll come back to it. Okay, so I'm going to follow on Seema's talk with a talk about the quality of informed consent and basically what the data show us about how well we're doing. So you'll see a lot of building on what she has already said to you this morning and other things that we've talked about in this class. Again, these are my views, not anybody else's. To reiterate what Seema said, whoops, I skipped ahead. Informed consent is a legal, regulatory, and ethical requirement of most research, but not all research with human subjects. It is, as she and others have said, one aspect of conducting ethical clinical research, but not the entire ethical way we do research. It's also a process. Most people recognize this. Informed consent is a process, not a form or a single episode. And I think it's important to recognize, though, although it is widely subscribed to and widely believed to be an important part of doing ethical research, it is imperfectly realized. And that's pretty much how I'm going to focus my talk. As Seema showed you, there are elements of informed consent, which pretty much everybody agrees on, including capacity, disclosure, understanding, voluntariness, and consent authorization. And I'm going to use these categories to talk about the data that have been collected to show us the quality of informed consent as we practice it in research. So far, the data that exists, although it's somewhat limited, there's more and more every year, the data on the quality of informed consent focuses on a couple of different things. It focuses on disclosure, what's disclosed to participants and what isn't. It focuses on the readability of consent documents or forms. It focuses on how much people do understand about research and a little bit on their motivations. And there are also some data comparing consent strategies, which compare strategies to try to improve understanding and satisfaction among participants of research. I think maybe we can all agree that research, empirical research in this area is, could be very helpful to understand, to improve, excuse me, our understanding of what the informed consent process looks like in various settings in research, what the written information looks like, what the participants' experience is, their understanding, how they make decisions, and what strategies work best to optimize all of these things, with, again, the goal of hoping that people have the information they need to be able to make an informed decision about whether they want to participate in research or continue to participate in research. So starting with disclosure, we could ask questions like, what information should be disclosed? And Seema already addressed this in two ways. The reasonable person standard, that's a legally accepted standard for deciding how much information, as well as the federal regulations, which actually delineate the categories of elements of information that need to be included when you're informing somebody for participation in research. There are also interesting questions about how the information should be presented, not just written, but verbally, and how we account for circumstances and settings. So I have a few cartoons to just lighten up the load here. I think one thing that many people recognize is that the way we currently conduct informed consent in research is generally way too much information, that, that people are just inundated with information. I think it's also really interesting to think about this issue of presentation. Some of us, how many of you have been involved in disclosing information to participants in the process of informed consent? Okay, so quite a few of you. So oftentimes the process for doing that is sitting down with somebody across a table or in the chairs close together and giving them the information and allowing for discussion and questions. Sometimes it's not so sort of collegial. I've seen, and I suppose you have as well, situations in where participants are sitting in a chair and the investigator is kind of standing over them in a certain way. Or participants are wanting to sort of have some time to think and process, and investigators are, you know, answering their pagers or running out the door or, you know, having a sense of let's get this over with so we can get on with the work kind of thing. So the presentation of information is critical. It's also important, of course, and this is obvious, but to think about the context. You know, there are some situations in which participants are in a context or in a set of circumstances where their ability to listen or absorb information is greatly impaired. And so we have to make amends for this. This doesn't mean that there are no times when people are in extremis that we cannot get in consent, because there are times when you have to. But we have to be very careful about what the circumstances are that the person is in. You've seen this, so I won't say anything about it. There are some information sheets on the OHSR website that give guidance to investigators about a number of different things. And one of them is how to write a consent document. And so some of these pieces of information are probably useful if you haven't already seen them. They're pretty straightforward and seem pretty obvious, but I think, again, we can ask the question of how well we attend to them. So one question to ask is the consent document written at a reading level that's understandable to the particular subjects that are going to be recruited for this study? Is the document formatted well? Does it have headings which break the text into short sections? I've seen consent documents of the 15, 16-page length with no headings at all, single space, small font. Does the document contain the basic elements for informed consent that are listed in the regulations, and are they presented in a clear and easy-to-understand way? And could the document or can the document be shortened without compromising clarity or other requirements? These are great questions, I think, to always ask us. So let's look at what the data is on disclosure. And there are two kinds of data. There are data that have, again, these are limited number of studies, but there are a few studies that have looked at consent documents with respect to either readability or content, and also a few studies that have looked at the consent discussion in terms of both content and the interaction between investigator and subject. What do the data show us on readability? this is a busy slide, but I don't think you need the details so much as to see that in every case, every study that's been conducted that I could find, the average reading level of consent documents is about the 11th or 12th grade or higher. One of them even showed that none of the, this is a study of a number of different oncology consent forms, and none of them were less than the eighth grade level. And yet the data suggests that in the United States, 50% of the population reads at or below the eighth grade level. So we are writing consent documents that don't reach 50% or more of the population. There's also studies that show that consent documents are long and, in fact, have increased in length over time. And these few studies, some of them are not so new, but some of them are newer, have showed that, in fact, we're getting worse in terms of the length of consent documents rather than better. We're making them longer. So again, this is what we're asking people to read. I saw a study the other day that was just trying to estimate reading time, average reading time, and the number of pages of consent documents, and suggested that for an average, a reasonable person to be able to read a consent document of 12 or 14 pages, it would take, given the average reading time, about 45 minutes to an hour. And yet there are some, at least anecdotal evidence, that suggests that people often read their consent documents in a couple of minutes. They flip through them and they're done. They've read them. So what about content? There have been a couple of studies, one that I think Zeke mentioned to you at a previous lecture that we did out of the department, where we looked at 267 phase one oncology consent forms, and we found with respect to content that almost all of them said the trial was research, the purpose was safety, that there was a right to withdraw, that death was a risk and that there were unknown risks, and very few said anything about cure as a possible benefit. So this maps to some extent the regulations that SEMA put up in terms of what elements need to be included. There have been a couple of other studies, though, that I think that suggest that there are lots of pieces of information. If you just compare what's in the consent documents with what the regulations require, there are lots of pieces of information that are missing. So this study looked at 16 consent documents at 16 sites for one study, one multicenter trial, and found that only three of them at the end contained all of the elements required by the regulations. These are IRB review. This other study looked at 27 different trials across four hospitals, and they found, again, significant information missing from the patient information and consent documents, again, comparing what was in the documents to what the regulations require. So what about interaction? There have been only a couple of studies. This was a study published in 1999, which looked at which videotaped the interaction between physicians and patients in oncology studies, and showed that in most of the interactions, the physicians described the study purpose, reviewed the treatments, tests, and procedures, and reviewed the alternatives. So that looks pretty good. There's another study, also a cancer study published a few years earlier. 60 investigators and 12 multicenter randomized controlled trials, and the data not quite as good. 58% reported giving all of the information. This is asking the physicians what they did. 42% only gave information on the proposed treatment arm. 12% did not inform the patients about the trial prior to randomizing them, and 5% did not seek consent at all. This is what they admitted to. Here's another study that looked at investigators of a multinational HIV study and, again, asked the investigators about their practices related to consent. Almost all of them gave participants a copy of the consent to read, gave the individuals an opportunity to read it before they signed it, presented a great deal of information about the risks and the purpose, emphasized randomization a little less, and I'm going to come back to this when we get to understanding, and a very small number had a formal way of assessing understanding of participants in the study. So given those few studies, what do we know about disclosure. We know that, first of all, there are limited data. There could be more studies. But that consent documents seem to include the relevant pieces of information in many but not all cases, but are very long and written at a very high level. That information offered to individuals is complex, and that disclosure by investigators in the process of discussion is quite variable. So what about understanding? If, in fact, the goal, and this is part of the previous discussion, is to give people the information in a way that they can understand it so that they can make a decision compatible with their own values and interests, it seems important to evaluate how much people actually do understand in the process of consent. There are, of course, many factors that one might imagine could affect understanding, affect a person's ability to understand. There's a very interesting debate, I think, about how should understanding be assessed. As you saw in that previous study, only less than 9% of investigators had some formal kind of assessment. Many people say that this is a sort of interactive clinical judgment kind of assessment and doesn't need a more formal tool. There are, of course, studies that incorporate more formal tools. There are some studies that have written tests for participants that they have to pass a certain at a certain level before they can be enrolled. There's also interesting debates about how much subjects should understand. What are the details of the study that are critical to illustrate a sufficient understanding to be able to make a decision compatible with one's interests? And there's a lot of debate that we could have about that. And then, of course, there's the question of what happens when subjects don't understand, or when they don't understand certain pieces of it, or what should happen when subjects don't understand certain pieces. Are there critical elements to a study that someone absolutely has to understand before we should enroll them? And does that vary from study to study? And, I mean, it's a very interesting debate that we could spend the rest of the day talking about. But we're not going to. We're going to look at the data. But before we do, some of the characteristics that one might imagine affect the ability to understand include age, severity of illness, and the need for treatment, educational level, cognitive capacity, familiarity with research, language and customs, capacity for free choice, and literacy. And some of the empiric studies have taken these kinds of factors into consideration, but not all of them have. So what do we know? From studies that have been done, and this is not an exhaustive list, this is a representative list, of the quality of informed consent, I've divided these into certain aspects of the study. So this slide is data reporting on how well people understand the research purpose or the nature, the fact that this is research and that there's a purpose to this research that's distinct from what they would get in clinical care. And you can see the range in this sampling is from as low as 27% to as high as 100% in terms of understanding the research purpose and nature. I've included both U.S.-based studies and studies in other parts of the world. And as I've reviewed these data, it has become clear to me that although there is some variation on particular studies, at least with respect to this, there's no distinction between developed countries and developing countries. There is a range of understanding of the nature of research and the purpose of research. And in general, it's pretty good compared to some other aspects of research that we want people to understand. What about risks and side effects? Dan mentioned before in his question that this is what people want to know the most, that they want to know what the risks are, and this is how they make their decision. And yet, when you look at studies that have tried to ask people to either tell you the risks that they remember or select them from a list, the range of responses, again, is pretty broad. From 28% in a hypertension trial in the U.S. of people that remembered two of the side effects that they were told about 2 hours after they gave consent, to 37% of cancer patients who could name some of the risks that, from a list, to 56% of mothers in the Gambia who could name more than one side effect of an HIV vaccine, to 100% of U.S. cancer patients in a phase one trial who could name at least one side effect of their phase one trial. So again, the range of remembering or being able to articulate risks of participation that have been told to people in consent is quite broad. Interestingly, in the studies that have been done, one of the hardest things for people to, it seems that the hardest thing that people have to understand is the concept of randomization. And so, although some of the previous slides have showed you a range that falls in the 20s to 100%, in all of the studies that have measured understanding of randomization, it's usually less than half of the people that are surveyed who actually understand what it means to be randomized. And so you can see on this slide, these are mothers in a pediatric malaria trial in Uganda who knew that, who were able to say that not all children would get the same treatment. This was a randomized trial. Injection drug users in an HIV vaccine trial, only 21%. Finnish women in a breast cancer trial, only 23% knew that their treatment was chosen randomly. 31% of Thai participants in an HIV treatment trial knew that only half, so only 31% knew that half would get the experimental treatment. And this is a U.S. beta blocker trial. 42% were aware of the existence of a control group. I have a couple of more. This is now related to randomization, but specifically asking about placebo controls. So in studies where the group is randomized to placebo versus an experimental treatment, again, some studies have shown a very poor understanding of the use of placebo in this case a vaccine trial in the Gambia, to a pretty high understanding of placebo. 67% in this rheumatoid arthritis trial knew that some people would get a placebo. What's interesting about these data is that although they could say that some people would get a placebo, fewer of them thought that they would. So there is this interesting distinction, as Seema suggested, between what people understand, the facts that they can tell you back, and what they appreciate or understand for their own experience. Some people have talked about this distinction between knowledge and appreciation or understanding and appreciation in the context of the therapeutic misconception, and I know we've talked about that in the course already, but the original paper that introduced this concept of the therapeutic misconception by Paul Applebaum and colleagues was a very interesting, insightful realization about this distinction. So in this particular study, this was a psychiatric study, excuse me, they interviewed participants immediately after consent, and 40% of them said that the assignment would be based on therapeutic needs, so that even though they knew, they were told that it was randomized and placebo-controlled, they thought, 40% of them thought that the decision would be made on what the therapeutic needs of the patients were, and 50% thought that the dosage would be adjusted according to their need. So basically what people said in this study was, oh, yes, I know they told me this is a randomized study. People will be randomized to the drug or placebo, but my doctor's going to adjust it for me the way I need it to be adjusted. I showed you that long list of things that might affect someone's ability to understand. Many of these studies have looked at things like education and age, and many of them have showed that education actually does have an effect on what people are able to tell you they understand about a study. So here's just a few. Education and speaking English at home, education and age, education and age. But there are a couple studies that have actually showed that neither education nor age made any difference in terms of the way people responded to the understanding questions in this study. And in this study, neither education nor previous research experience made a difference in terms of what people's understanding was of the particular details of the study, which is, you know, maybe surprising, actually. So, to summarize the data on understanding, again, not very satisfying, but the understanding of participants in research is quite variable. Most subjects seem to know that they are in research, and there's a relatively high percentage in most studies that can say something about the purpose and the nature of research. Randomization seems to be one of the most poorly understood concepts in research. It's clear that understanding is not the same as appreciation, and in some studies this can be teased apart. And there are various things that might affect a person's ability to understand. The two that have been studied most frequently are age and education, and they do seem to affect understanding in most cases, but not always. So what about voluntariness? As Seema pointed out, there are two ways to think about this. They're very connected. One is the ability to make a choice, and a free choice, and free meaning not subject to coercion or undue influence. So this is not the kind of consent process we want to see happening. Oh, I love this cartoon. Hopefully you've never seen this. So again, there are lots of things that we might hypothesize would affect a person's ability to make a voluntary choice. And I think it's probably safe to say none of us are completely making choices completely free of any influences. There are influences all over the place that have to do with just who we are and our experiences. But when we put people into the position of trying to make decisions about research, there are also these other very logical things that might make a difference in terms of how free the choice might be. So illness, how ill you are, how well-treated you've been in the past. Being in a dependent position, you know, how much you rely on your physician or how much you rely on your, Seema showed an example of a lab chief and an employee. Power relationship, which is related to dependent position but can be separated. How much you trust your healthcare provider. There have been studies that have showed that people participate in research because they trust their doctor and their doctor told them it was a good idea. Restricted choices. How do restricted choices affect your ability to make a free choice? Family pressures. And then, of course, incentives, which we've talked about in this course already. So I think, interestingly, in the empiric measurement of the quality of informed consent, it's a challenge to think about how does one measure voluntariness. And there are three ways that, in the studies that have been done to date, this has been tackled. One is just numbers that demonstrate that people can and do choose not to participate. So the people who are offered participation who say no. If you show that there are some people who can do that, then you assume that they've made a voluntary choice. People have also tried to measure pressure. How much pressure does one feel to join the study, either from other people or from circumstances? And a third way that voluntariness has been measured in some of these studies is through knowledge. Knowledge of the ability or the right to refuse or withdraw. So I'm going to look at some of the data in these three areas. So there are a couple of studies, there are probably more out there than these, but I've just picked a couple, that show that at least a percentage of people who are offered participation in a particular study refuse. And you might feel that this is sufficiently indicative of the fact that people have a choice, that some people can say no. 9% may be more average than 58%, but there are studies out there that have a wide range. What about pressure to join? There have been a couple of studies. This study conducted by the Advisory Committee on Human Radiation Experiments in the United States asked questions about pressure, and only 2% of the 570 participants said they felt any pressure to join. In this study of the mothers in Uganda who enrolled their children in a malaria treatment trial, 15% said they felt some pressure from others to enroll their child in the treatment trial. And when this was broken down with respect to who they felt pressure from, it seemed equally, the pressure seemed to be equally applied by family members, spouses, and clinicians. Yet the same cohort said a much larger percentage, 58% of them, felt pressure to join because of their child's illness. They felt like this was an important thing for them to do because their child was ill. In another study, 25% of Dutch parents of children in an anticonvulsant study said they felt obliged to participate in the study. What about knowing that they're free to withdraw from a study? Again, there's some variation. 44%, which is less than half, of Swedish women in a GYN trial knew that they could quit. 48% of Bangladeshi women, pregnant women in an iron supplement trial said they knew that they could quit. In this study, 88% of the vaccine trial participants said they knew they could refuse at any time. One might argue that to the extent that research is supposed to be voluntary, 88% is too small of a number to have people know that they have the right to refuse. Here's some more. 90% of U.S. oncology patients in all phases of trials said they knew they could quit. 96% in a rheumatoid arthritis study said they didn't have to stay if they didn't want to, so they knew they could quit. Here's a really interesting set of data. 93% of South African women in an HIV transmission study said they knew they were free to quit, but 98% of them said the clinic would not let them quit. So that's an interesting distinction between what they know is true and what they feel is possible. What do we know about voluntariness? I should have had a conclusion slide there. First of all, we know that none of the measures of voluntariness that we currently are using are perfect. Some of them are measuring knowledge of ability to quit. We also know that knowledge of ability to quit, although it's pretty good in many studies, is not 100% in any study, and that's a question of whether or not that's tolerable. We also know that from studies that have looked at pressure, relatively few people report feeling any pressure from other people, but more people report feeling pressure from their circumstances, either their health circumstances or other circumstances. And I think this kind of data really requires more exploration. What are the differences here in terms of why people feel, why they know they can, but they feel they can't? What's that all about? So what about interventions? There have been a number of studies that have tried to look at interventions with an effort to improve the understanding of the participants in the study. Some of them have looked at understanding alone. Some have looked at understanding and satisfaction. And this is a sort of summary slide from a review article that was published a couple of years ago that took all of the data that's been published up until that time, that studied interventions to improve understanding and consent. And they grouped them into four categories. The multimedia studies that have used things like audio tapes, videotapes, and interactive computers. The enhanced consent form studies, which have looked at either modifying the style, the format, or the length of the consent document. A group of studies that looked at extended discussion, randomizing people to the normal process versus more time with an investigator or a nurse or a neutral educator. And then a small group of studies that have looked at what is called test feedback, where people are given quizzes. To the extent that they get one or more of the answers wrong, they're given feedback on what those items are that they didn't understand well enough, and then tested again. And so what do these studies show? As a group, neither the multimedia strategies, i.e. the videotapes, the audio tapes, et cetera, or computers, nor the enhanced consent forms, i.e. altering the length or style of the consent forms, consistently improved understanding. So as a group, none of these studies consistently improved understanding. However, they may be good as our usual process of giving informed consent. They may be more appropriate for certain populations. They may be useful in standardizing disclosure, especially like videotapes and things like that. And in some studies, they appear to improve satisfaction. So in studies, for example, that have looked at graphically simpler consent forms versus the standard ones that we use, people generally report they liked them better. They understood them better, even though they didn't always. There was a recent publication in the Cochrane database of systematic reviews that looked at audiovisual interventions in particular, and they actually looked at only four trials, which involved this many people. But basically, they found the same thing that the Florian Emanuel review found, that use of audiovisual interventions in the process of informed consent did not consistently increase participants' levels of knowledge or understanding. One study showed better retention of knowledge amongst the intervention recipients, and they also looked at willingness to participate, and they showed that audiovisual interventions for consent seemed to transiently increase people's willingness to participate, but that this willingness to participate was not sustained, so it disappeared after 2 to 4 weeks. So, again, considerable uncertainty about the effects. Their conclusion, Florian Emanuel, was that limited data suggests that more person-to-person contact, the extended discussion studies, and the test feedback strategies may actually help to improve understanding. Now, I want to show you two things about this that are very important. One is that the number of studies in which this was tested was very small, 5 in each of these groups. And in the first group, improved or extended contact, 3 out of the 5 showed some improvement in understanding, so not 5 out of 5. In the second group, 5 out of 5 showed improvement of understanding. But this strategy of test feedback has been criticized on one important feature, which I think is worth thinking about, and that is if you give somebody a test and you review the items that they got wrong, and then you give them the same test again, they are likely to do better the second time. Now, does that indicate that they understand better what the information was, or that they are able to understand how to answer the question to get it right? I mean, and those are very interesting distinctions that are worth keeping in mind if you're testing these kinds of strategies. Another review article suggested that none of the intervention studies to date clearly identified methods that increase knowledge, satisfaction, or affect actual decisions. So I want to suggest that there's certainly room for more research on informed consent, both on the quality of informed consent and on interventions to try to improve our process, because you can see from the data that I've shared with you, it's not a perfect process. There's a lot of areas in which we could do better in terms of what people understand. But I think it's worth in this class talking a little bit about what are the challenges to doing research on informed consent. So there are some conceptual challenges, certainly the ones that have been raised, like how do you separate measuring understanding, what people know, what knowledge they've retained, versus appreciation? How do they really incorporate that knowledge into making a decision for themselves about whether or not this applies to me and this affects how I'm going to decide whether I want to participate? That's an interesting challenge in terms of measuring the quality of informed consent. Similarly, and I've already raised the issue of voluntariness, how do you measure whether somebody's making a voluntary decision? And although there are some ways that people have done it, and I think they're reasonable ways, there may be others that haven't been tried yet. There are also interesting design issues in terms of should the quality of their consent be measured in the real setting of trials that they've already agreed to participate in, or in a simulated situation, you know, where you give people information and then test their understanding of the information you've given. And do those two kinds of experiments give you different information about understanding? Can you really simulate the kinds of influences that somebody who's deciding to participate in the study is operating under? Most of these studies have been done as survey research. Survey research is a great modality for lots of things, but it has its limitations. There are also some really interesting measurement issues. To date, every study in informed consent that's been done uses different set of questions. So there is no standardization of the kinds of questions that people are asking. Now, at least there is standardization around the elements of informed consent so that people are asking questions about, do you understand the nature of research? Do you understand the purpose? Do you understand the procedures? Do you understand the risks? But the questions with which they ask those understandings are different from survey to survey. There's also remarkable variation in terms of the timing of questions. So I think Seema mentioned the distinction between understanding and recall, which I think is a very interesting and important distinction. If we're interested in what people understand at the time they make a decision, then we need to be measuring their understanding at the time they make the decision, or very close in time. Some of the studies that have looked at the quality of informed consent have measured what people understand or what they recall hours later, weeks later, in some cases years later. And those are really measures of different things, because you, whatever you understand at the time you're making a decision, you may not remember a year later, and that's measuring something different. There's also true that most of these studies have been done in relatively small cohorts, and most of them have been single institution studies. So there's lots of room for larger, across lots of institutions or even countries, kinds of studies in informed consent. There are also, those of us who have tried to do this kind of research have encountered some interesting challenges in terms of the process of doing it as well, and I think these are worth just mentioning to you. One is IRB approval. IRBs are very worried about modifying the way we do informed consent. And it's actually interesting because most of them, most of the ones that I'm aware of that I've even encountered myself or have read about in the literature, are very supportive of the idea of making the process of informed consent better. But they're skittish about shortening consent forms or simplifying information or modifying the information in a way that that's unfamiliar to the way business is usually done. So this is an interesting challenge for trying to make it better. Clinical investigators, in order to evaluate the quality of the understanding of participants in a trial, often you either have to be doing the trial yourself or collaborate with the investigators who are doing the trial. And there's always this worry that if you find that people don't understand very well, does that look bad? Does that reflect badly on me, that we're not doing a good job in terms of informed consent? There's also worries about the possibility of disrupting the flow. So there's a certain flow that happens when somebody's being considered for participation in a study. They're given the information in a written document. They discuss it with members of the staff. Then they decide, and then they sign up. And if you try to insert into that process a different intervention or a measurement of what they're understanding, it kind of disrupts the flow. It's also an interesting challenge in obtaining informed consent of people that you want to measure how they understand informed consent. You don't want to confuse them by saying, I need your informed consent to understand what you understand about this other study. I mean, it's a very interesting process and one that we've been challenged with at both the IRB level and at the intervention level at the individual. And then there's this persistent question of what do you do if in real time you discover that people just don't get it, that they've just enrolled in a study and they have no idea what they've just enrolled in? Is there something you, as a researcher, that you should do to feed back that information to the clinical team or the clinical investigative team of the original study? So these are really interesting questions that I'd be happy to talk about. To conclude, as I mentioned, there are an increasing number of studies on informed consent. Most are small, most are single site. There's variable timing, there's non-standard questions. It's difficult to make comparisons of the nature that I did make. It is definitely the case that informed consent in research is ethically important but seems to be imperfectly realized. I believe that we need more and more rigorous data on this issue. And again, the available data suggests that consent forms are very complex, that understanding is quite variable and especially lacking in certain, perhaps key areas like randomization and side effects, that more than we would probably like do not know or do not feel that they can quit at any time, and that spending more time with people may enhance understanding, at least in the small group of studies that have tried to measure that. Questions or comments? All Ron.
Christine, I think, you know, as long as we're expecting this one document to serve two masters, the legal protection of all parties involved, as we heard earlier, and then, you know, truly informing patients or subjects of what they're to be exposed to, even your study data suggests lots of these documents are lacking the, you know, essential features called for even in federal law. So the idea that we can make them shorter seems preposterous. I mean, we sign real estate contracts that are written in a language that even those of us with postgraduate education rarely understand, but we're, you know, given the opportunity to back out. My question is this. Instead of trying to have the informed consent document teach all these things, like what is randomization, has anyone ever tried a class, for example, here on Mondays when our new patients show up, an hour class explaining these terms outside of the actual protocol process, but something given like you're giving to us, and to test the effect then after people just sit and discuss randomization, you know, what does therapeutic misconception mean? Would they do better in understanding the true informed consent document that they're participating in vis-a-vis their study protocol?
It's a great question. I am aware of groups that do have group discussions. I don't know if I'd call them classes. Group discussions of features of research that precede the individual informed consent process. So in other words, they bring the cohort of people that might be considering it together and they talk about the study in a general way. That's kind of, I think, what you're suggesting, although not the abstract concepts of randomization, but more specific to the study. I'm also aware, and probably many of you are as well, there are a growing number of pamphlets and patient or participant information available that are sort of generic. And the NCI has one. The CRISPIC, I don't know what they stand for. There's a number of educational materials available to research participants which try to explain general concepts like the phases of clinical trials, like randomization and control, like what informed consent is, and things like that. And those are available. Whether or not they've been tested to see whether, you know, they improve the understanding, I'm not aware of that. But they may have, and I just may not know about it. So that's another interesting concept. I think also people have, the AAMC has a project right now where they're suggesting that the consent documents, the written materials, be broken up into different pieces. One that sort of satisfies the legal requirement of getting people to agree to something and making that very short and very legalistic, supplemented by a particular description of the study, supplemented by appendices that explain details of things that some individuals may want but others would not. And I think they are testing that to understand, to see if understanding varies in that kind of way. And there are lots of different, I'm aware of different projects out there testing different strategies of, for example, my own research, I'm trying to show that you can, in fact, reduce the length and the complexity of a consent document and include all of the elements that are required by the federal regulations. And there's three or four studies that I've been involved in so far where I've taken 15, 16-page consent documents and made them four pages. And every element is in there, and I don't think anything has been compromised. Now, we're in the process of measuring understanding, so I don't know where that will go, but we'll see. Yeah.
Has any research been done examining the investigators and whether or not they're aware of deficits in understanding among subjects? I would guess that investigators obtaining consent in randomized controlled trials would behave fairly differently if they realized that only 50% of subjects on average understand the process of randomization.
Good question. And there was one study that I showed earlier about asking investigators about the kinds of, you know, breaking up the sort of elements of disclosure that one might need to include in a consent document and a discussion, and asking investigators how much they emphasized each of these areas. And what was striking about those data, which was one study and a small study, the emphasis that investigators said they gave to randomization was much less than the emphasis that they gave to things like risks or purpose of the study. It was about 56%, I think, as opposed to 80 and 90% for the others. So the question is, why is that? And the particular study didn't follow up with why is that. But I think one possible anecdotal explanation is that it's hard to explain. It's hard to explain in a way that people really do understand. And there are some people who contend it's not even that important for people to understand randomization. I'm not one of those, but there are people who make that argument. So there is room for more studies of how investigators and research staff present information to people and what they do emphasize and how they do sort of explain these difficult concepts like randomization, which people do have trouble understanding. And I'm not sure, I mean, Seema gave a couple of examples of different ways that people in different cultures have decided to express what randomization is all about. But part of the problem, I think, is because it's so foreign to what people expect when they go into a healthcare facility that they're going to be randomized, it's part of this worry about the therapeutic misconception. They're so ingrained to expect the doctor will look out for them and make a decision that's compatible with what they need. And they're not really using this flip of a coin or computer or digging into a bag to decide what's going to happen to me. That may be what they say they're going to do, but that's not how they do it. I think that's part of what we're fighting against in terms of understanding. But it's a great question, and more research certainly is needed. Owen.
So I had a question about the your measurements on the quality of voluntariness. And yeah. I was wondering, I think some of the metrics you offered weren't, I mean, they seemed a little inadequate at measuring voluntariness, like the ability to say no, kind of this percentages of accrual. I mean, it seems like even like 100, if 100% of people, you know, agreed to participate in a study, that doesn't necessarily mean a lack of voluntariness. It could be just a larger amount of altruism or a very favorable risk-benefit ratio. So, I mean, like, those percentages in themselves, they don't really indicate anything about voluntariness. And also with the pressure to join, I mean, I guess you gave us a brief one-sentence summaries, but was there any real, like, further investigation about the exact source of this pressure? Because, like, with the Dutch stat you mentioned, they felt an obligation to join, 25%. Was that, like, a moral obligation, or was that, a legal obligation, or
okay. Great questions. Again, room for lots more study on this issue. And I think I hoped to emphasize that how we measure voluntariness is very difficult and very imperfect. And certainly the numbers of people that say no to a study, I 100% agree with you, only indicate that some people can say no. The fact that 100% of people approached for a given study said yes doesn't mean they didn't have a choice. But the fact that some people say no in some studies indicates that some people make a choice. So it's an imperfect measure, absolutely, but it is a measure that at least some people are making a choice different than the majority. I don't know the details of the particular study in the Dutch, the one that you were referring to, but I think that one of the limitations of survey research is that you ask a question and you get a frequency of response to that question that you don't always get an explanation for why. And so some of these studies are limited by that. They have an answer to a question, which is very interesting, but no explanations. And so, again, the need for more and maybe different types of research on these issues.
Kira. I'm wondering whether there is any study done on the correlation between understanding and participation into trials, in the sense that it's kind of striking to see that so many research and so many attention from lawyers, doctors, physicians, groups, patients group, etc., has been put on this, right. And yet we are not getting to good results in terms of understanding. And I'm wondering how much fears plays into that.
Yeah.
So if there was a study showing that relationship, maybe that would push things in one sense or the other.
It's a great question, and you would, you know, logically think that people who have been in research before would have a better understanding of what it's about. I'm only aware of two types of data that address this question. One is I think I might have shown a study, a multinational HIV study where the participants were evaluated for what they understood about the study, and we also asked questions about their previous experience. And there was no correlation between previous research experience and understanding on certain variables, which is quite interesting and maybe surprising. And these people actually had a fairly extensive, it wasn't in most cases just one study they had been in before. The other place where I've seen it looked at is in the phase one oncology setting, where people have tried to correlate understanding with previous experience in research and also previous treatment for cancer. And there is a little bit of a correlation, but it's not consistently found. So I think it's very problematic. Nathan, I would love to take your question, but I'm going to actually talk to you individually because I don't want to slight the panel. So I would like you to take a break and try to get back here by 10:30 so that we can get as much time as we can with the participant panel. Thank you very much. Okay, we're going to start. For the last session of today, we are honored to have with us four people who have participated in research here at the NIH who are going to talk to us about their experiences as research participants with the goal of giving us a better flavor of what it's like. Now, it has always been interesting to me, and we've been doing this course now 10 years, many of us in the room spend our days interacting with people who are participating in research. And yet, sometimes the insights that I hear at this course are things that I haven't heard before. So I really, really appreciate each of you coming here and sharing with us your experience. The way we're going to do this, I've asked each of our participants to spend a couple of minutes just describing their experience to you, and then we will open it up for discussion and questions. And as I mentioned this morning, although we were talking about informed consent today, informed consent is not the only thing you can ask. There are many things about the research participation experience that are open to discussion. So please feel free to ask the questions that seem most pertinent to you. Our panelists, starting on my side and working to the other side, are Ellen, Beatrice, Kaimon, and Richard. And each of them, in turn, will give you a couple of minutes of their experience. So, Ellen?
Greetings. I want to start by saying thank you. Thank you for your interest in research and for your participation in this class. Without you, my success wouldn't have been possible. I received an islet cell transplant in 2001. Previous to that, I'd had diabetes for 40-some years, and I suffered severe hypoglycemia unawareness, and I would pass out with no warning, sometimes while I was driving the car. I always knew, I think a lower consciousness took over and said, stop the car, and I'd stop the car. Sometimes it would be on the side of the road. The next thing I would remember would be the emergency personnel giving me a glucose IV. And I had been to my doctor many, many times. What can I do about this? There's no warning. Every single time I got in the car, I took my blood sugar, and it would be okay. Then I would wake up. Well, I would finally wake up after I received a glucose IV. So I was desperate, and I had heard through the news media about islet cell transplants, where the islet cells from a dead person's pancreas are put into a recipient. I was lucky enough to be one of those recipients. But I self-referred myself to NIH. I did discuss it with my doctor first, and she said, yeah, go ahead. We can't figure anything out. So I came with a real sense of hope, like maybe this would work. And as I went through the process, which was a very, very lengthy process to determine my eligibility, many, many aspects of the clinical trial were discussed with me. I was given a copy of the trial. I had been online to see what it was. I had downloaded it. I had discussed it with my doctor, with my family. I came here. I was interviewed. They discussed it with me again, almost line by line. Then I was told to take it home and bring it back again. Did I have any questions? Which I did. And throughout that process, it was always emphasized to me that this is the definition of a trial. You don't know what's going to happen. It's a trial. So there were lots of unknowns. They weren't certain, and they were very honest. My doctor, Dr. Harlan, David Harlan, said, you know, we don't know if it's going to work. You know, I was the sixth one that they did at NIH, and they had been successful with the others, but they didn't know about me. They also explained that they didn't know what the results and the side effects of the drugs would be. So I wasn't hesitant to participate. I understood all that, but I was passing out with no warning. So I had to do something. I received one transplant, although the protocol called for two. The one transplant was enough islet cells that I became insulin independent after like 2 weeks. And then I was insulin independent for almost a year and a half. It was a great time. I didn't have to take insulin every day. And I the best part was I wasn't passing out. That's why I did it, you know, because I had learned to live with the shots, you know. I'd been doing that my whole life. I had learned to count carbs. None of that was anything new. But that unawareness was the really frightening part, which is why I joined the trial. Without that component, I probably wouldn't have done it. I would have waited to see what happens. What happened, of course, was as many of the islet cell transplants have occurred, is that the islets become less effective over time. I was put back on insulin, which, you know, I can still live with that. I take a very small amount now because they put me back on insulin because they didn't want the islets to wear out. And when I say they put me back, I'm part of a team. I have a very important role in all the decisions that are made. And sometimes I don't agree with those decisions. And sometimes then I don't do it. And one time that happened, they wanted to stop one drug, and I said, you know, I don't think that's the one that's causing the difficulty. We discussed it endless amounts of time. And it turned out my decision was the correct one. So I am part of that team, and my input is critical for the decisions that are made. After all, it's my body, and it's my disease. It's not theirs. It's not yours. It's mine. So it's been successful for me. I have had side effects from the drug, from all the drugs. I take many drugs. But, you know, my body finally decided after I kind of got used to the side effects that, okay, I guess we're going to have to be taking these. We better learn to tolerate them. And it did get better. And now, you know, my immune system is depressed. I'm not, but my immune system is, you know, and I love that, you know. And I have to be careful when I'm around people that are sick, because if I'm around somebody and, like, I work with young children, and if they have a cold, I get pneumonia, you know, or I get bronchitis, and I end up in the hospital. But I've learned to tolerate that, and I've learned what to do, and I know the warning signs, and I know that I have to do something right away, or else it blows up really big. But would I participate again? Yes, without a moment's hesitation, because it worked for me. It doesn't work for everybody. But I understood that when I started, too. Thank you.
Good morning. Thank you all for coming today. My name is Beatrice Bowie. I prepared a speech because I was getting ready. Sometimes I'll be well sitting here with you in the next 10 minutes. I'll have a pain crisis attack from the sickle cell disease. So I figured if I'm not well to be here today, at least somebody can read a speech for me. So if it's all right with everybody, I'll read a speech that I prepared. Good morning, Dr. Grady, doctors, nurses, medical staff, ladies and gentlemen. First, I would like to say thank you to Dr. Grady and the NIH staff for giving me the opportunity to participate in this panel discussion. My name is Beatrice Bowie. I'm 56 years old, born with a genetic defect of my red blood cells, a disease commonly known as sickle cell anemia. I must tell you, I'm very grateful that there is a place called America where I'm able to get the best medical care in the world. For the past 6 years, I have been a patient at the NIH, enrolled in the research study program to find a cure for sickle cell anemia. I'm very happy to inform you, in the case you didn't know, that there has been a remarkable breakthrough for finding a cure for the hereditary disease. Dr. Gregory Cato, working with the bone marrow transplant team of doctors and medical staff, as I understand it, has actually been able to cure about 10 sickle cell patients with bone marrow taken from genetically matched siblings. I myself have greatly benefited from the NIH sickle cell research program that gives his patients access to wound care treatment, and especially the pain and palliative department, which comprises of pain management, mental health, hypnosis, spiritual ministry, physical, occupational, and recreational therapies, acupuncture treatment, and many creative and innovative practices in the healing arts. The feeling one gets as one enters the clinical building 10 is a welcome one. The friendly greeting by the staff in the hospitality desk, the polite and prompt assistance from the escort service employees helping the physically handicapped with wheelchairs, the nurses at wards 3 Southeast South, the Day Hospital, 5 Southeast South, 3rd floor ICU, Echo Lab, Outpatient Clinic, OP3 Clinic, Clinic OP7, which cater for the sickle cell and the Parkinson patients, and also the eye clinic OP number 10, which I frequently visit, perform their duties with such thoughtful compassion. I believe they give a whole new meaning to the expression service with a smile. The spirit of Clara Barton and Florence Nightingale really shines through. Even so, despite the many who are so very dedicated to serving and helping patients, it seems sometimes there are few of the medical staff that occasionally didn't take into service account the perspective of their colleagues, and most especially their patients' past experiences with particular medication or treatment. The remedy for these few cases, I suggest, is to put aside whatever preconceived notions or assumptions you may have, and please listen to your patients and consider their opinions and experiences. I'm very grateful for the great work that NIH sickle cell research team has been doing and continues to do. It is no exaggeration to say, you have saved my life. Without you, I wouldn't be here today. I have hoped, and if I can find a donor sibling with a genetically matched bone marrow, then I too will be counted among the cured who are no longer afflicted with this genetic disorder, sickle cell anemia. Then one day perhaps I can finally be free from the cycle of sickle cell crisis and the awful pain they bring. Thank you for listening, and God bless you.
Good morning. My name is Kimon Freeman. I participated in AIDS vaccine clinical trials here in NIH. I also participated in our Everyday Heroes ad campaign. My face was seen on posters throughout the Metro Transit system alongside some personal heroes of mine, Harriet Tubman and Mark Twain. So I have lent my face and my name and my body to basically increasing awareness and giving a higher profile for this issue. And oftentimes the most repeated question that I have from friends and family and associates is why? I'm attempt to explain that to you today. My first response to the question of why I would have done these things, I usually repeat the fact that my uncle died of AIDS, and my entire family was ashamed of that, asked us to not repeat that, blame it on cancer or some other various disease. And I think this is addiction to a silence that's providing fertile ground for the continued spread of this disease. So that's my general response, but it's deeper than that. Sometimes I'm engaged in further discussion. I tell them that, well, you know, during my first encounter with the clinical trial team and the attempt to recruit me, I was told that basically that vaccines are the best hope in stemming this pandemic because there are no current pharmaceutical companies aggressively searching for cures because the money is in providing the treatment. It's a bad business plan. If you are here on a profit margin to provide a cure when you make more money off of providing long-term treatment. But it's deeper than that on why I participated. I'm also in possessive of information that gave me the initiative and incentive before these things occurred in my life, and I want to share them with you. Henry Kissinger in 1974 said that depopulation should be the highest priority of foreign policy towards the third world. Prince Philip in 1988 said, in the event that I'm reincarnated, I would like to return as a deadly virus in order to contribute something to solve overpopulation. Ted Turner said that 95% population decline from present levels would be ideal and pledged in 1998 $1 billion to UN implementing population reduction policies. Bill Gates has followed suit with $30 billion to population control groups, and so has his good friend Warren Buffett. When we talk about AIDS and the fact that it's been decreasing the life expectancy on the continent of Africa because of this pandemic, when we talk about just something as simple as this, 25,000 people die every single day in third world countries across this world every day simply because they don't have access to clean water. That's 9 million people a year. That's more than any infectious diseases we now currently know. So when we talk about stemming somehow a pandemic and saving lives, I question the will of the international community in doing so. When we look at from the you know, Rwanda to, you know, the levees breaking in New Orleans, we've seen over and over the government having systemic disregard for life. And I have done what I can as an individual to raise the flag of concern. And I think that we all need to analyze the, for lack of a better word, the will of the funding, the will of the initiatives that we're really talking about. Well, what's holding this up? Why this is not working? Why this has not been done? Bureaucracy, I believe, serves a function. And, you know, we again, are at the will of science effect on community. You know, my point of view is that science is here to improve the quality of life. But in other people's hands, science could be here to, you know, scan my face or read your lips or analyze your walk, you know. But I think that most of the people are here, I would like to believe, are here in order to improve the quality of life. And what I've done in donating my name, my face, and my energy, and my blood, and my sweat, and my tears has been to doing just that. And I think that coming out of Washington, D.C., which has the highest infection AIDS rate in the city, I mean, excuse me, in the country, excuse me, and I've seen over and over, again, systemic disregard for life and concern of the people being mostly affected by that, because I am personally responsible for the largest annual AIDS mobilization in Washington, D.C. That means me, a poor poet, has launched the largest AIDS testing event in the nation's capital with no funding. So that means the government is either unwilling or unable to do what's necessary. So that's why I participated in NIH. That says a lot because being a black man in first generation post-apartheid America, I gave some credibility to NIH because of how they spoke to me in a frank manner. I believe that they are sincere, and that is why I participated. That's why I supported it. And if given the opportunity, I may just do that again. But the reason I'm here today is, again, to raise the flag of concern and question authority and have an iconoclastic approach to solving the world's problems today. And I thank you for your time for listening.
Good morning, everyone. Started on a on a three-arm study at NIH back in 1988. I found out I was HIV positive and had a partner die in 1989, so I started looking around for other ways to treat myself for the disease than what was out there. He had only AZT at his, you know, for his use. And I found an ad one time in a local newspaper that when I was living in Phoenix, and it was for a study that was starting here at NIH. So in 1989, I called that phone number and was invited to come out and find out if I would qualify for a study here at NIH. I did indeed qualify for that study, and I've been coming here for, well, ever since 1989, December of 89 was my first visit here. So I think I'm on my seventh study here now, have signed numerous informed consent forms, as you can well imagine, with strange names like 3ARM and Optica and the latest one, Trans-Am, which is really a cool name. I'm really grateful that that this place is here, and that you all are so interested in what's going on. And let me tell you, from the informed consent process, when you first, we were discussing this before we even got started here. When patients come to NIH, or when their doctors refer them here, they are at the end of their rope, because they probably pretty much tried every other treatment that's out there. So when they get to NIH, it's their last resort. And they may not listen to you when it comes to the informed consent, because they think, you know, they're thinking more about staying alive instead of what it means to be involved in a clinical trial. But I can tell you, you know, 20 years down the road, I really understand what it means to be involved in a clinical trial. So I stick around now as, my friends back home call me a lab rat. So, you know, I figure whatever information they can glean from me will help further the education of the physicians and everyone else in hopefully finding a cure. I'm grateful that there are healthy volunteers that show up and do this as well. So thank you all for your interest, and go from there. Questions?
So please come to the mics to ask questions. Thank you all. Go ahead, Ron.
Our last guest brought up an area of interest to all of us. We're concerned with risks that people have to undertake to become research patients here, and how one understands those risks when they're presented to you in these informed consent statements. So I'm curious whether one or all of you might share with us how you thought about those risks that were written in that consent form, informed statement that you signed, before you made a decision to actually enter into the clinical trial, or whether the risk statement had any bearing whatsoever on your decision.
You know, the risk were clearly explained, but at the point that I was, okay, I can put up whatever they're saying. Yeah, okay, so I might have a little diarrhea, I might be tired. I didn't really understand what that meant, but I was willing to go ahead, because at this point I was desperate for something to work. So they were there, but they were kind of in the background. But always I was told again and again and again, any time that I wanted to drop out, I could. That was my decision. You know, if I found that the side effects of the drugs were much too intense for me, then I could drop out. And that did actually happen to someone else in my trial. The side effects of the drugs, they could not tolerate. But that was always a possibility, but it wasn't a major concern. And all those things that they did specify as side effects, they happened to me, but the intensity that they happened was different for each person. So how each person reacts to those drugs is something to be considered. You know, I know it's necessary to list every possible side effect. One possible side effect is you'll get hit by a car when you're crossing the street, you know, because you had your eyes closed or something. But I know that's necessary, but it is not the primary important thing for a patient when you're at the point that you're here.
Good morning, sir. What happened to me, I was born back in the old country. It was called the British Gold Coast. Now it's called Ghana. When I was born, my mom was told that I would not live to see my second birthday. And before I came here, I had 3 hip replacement surgeries due to the dying of my bones. The doctors call it osteonecrosis. I weighed like 100, I was like 150 pounds or so, but then I was 98 pounds when I got here. The doctors declared that I would not even live to in 2 weeks or a month. All the doctors from Howard University Hospital, Shady Grove Hospital, and all the numerous hospitals I visited, Georgetown, I had a leg ulcer, which was caused by the disease. Because as you're getting older, the disease causes the degeneration process in your system. Everything keeps shutting down. And that's like a walking dead, you know. You are dead, but you're still walking around because the bones inside are dying. The last time I saw one of the doctors at Howard with the leg ulcer, which was about 15 inches in diameter on my left leg, I decided, well, what am I supposed to lose? Even if they're doing intrusive, whatever they're doing to me, it's better than living with all these problems. So once I was introduced to come here, I was very grateful. And the evidence is clear. After 6 years, I'm here talking. So despite all the side effects, which sometimes I go through, it doesn't really bother me. That's why I came, and I'm very grateful that I did.
I might understand that you were saying, like, what is the concerns about the stated side effects that may intimidate you from participating? Is that what I'm...
Yes, at each aspect of the process, the review and so forth, and even the writing of it, one is very concerned about being honest in stating to you the risks you're likely to incur. What we have less ability to understand is how you as an individual then make that decision to accept those risks and participate.
Yeah, okay. Intimidating, a bit daunting when you went through that list and they had to tell you about, you know, all the things that could fall off, you know, by participating. Yeah. And footnote, I think that it would better serve the program if you had like a partner or contact with someone that previously participated in some sort of way of communicating, mm-hmm. so that, you know, that I used to tease and say I had hair when I started, you know, it is intimidating. So I think that if someone was there to, you know, someone hold your hand and say, look, well, this is what you can expect because I participated. This is what happened to me. I think that would help alleviate some of those concerns. But without that, it is intimidating, but I can tell you that from my personal experience that I didn't have any ill side effects from anything. I was bald when I started. I think either the first or second time I did get sick. I was ill for a while. Then that could be contributed to, you know, a lot of things, but that was the only thing I can say that happened. But the list of things that they say that could happen, you know, it is somewhat intimidating. You're like, whoa, you know, I'm really risking my health about this thing. But I can say for what I participated in, I didn't have any adverse side effects. The side effects that I suffered from my participation was social, not physical. And if you want to talk about that, I can have a conversation. But as far as the intimidation factor, I think that could be mostly alleviated if you had contact with a person that already participated.
It's funny that you said that you think it would be great if there was somebody there that has already gone through it. During my last clinical visit, we talked about just exactly that with all the new trials that are coming down the pike. The one I would just signed up for, the Trans-Am study, is a liver biopsy study. It would have been nice to have known how much I was going to hurt, once I went through the liver biopsies. But really, we've joked about it a lot, in that when we get these informed consent forms, and that's what they've become now, they've become forms. It's not just a sheet of paper now. It's a form. There are 5 pages of the possible side effects and the detriments, and there are 2 lines that say the possible benefits of what this is. As I said in the beginning, when you first, if you're reaching somebody who is coming here for the very first time, they probably really don't care what those things are, and so you've got to be very clear. They've got to understand, we were discussing this earlier, this is a research facility. This is not a curing facility. Their cures are found here, but this is a research facility, and I understand that. And that was initially when I came here, there wasn't a cure for HIV, and I knew that. But I knew that by my participation, that no matter what, the study I got randomized to, the 3-arm study, was AZT versus interferon, or both together. And I got randomized to the AZT-only arm, which was the exact same medication that my partner had been on and had taken for 3 years and died on. And I thought, well, okay, maybe they'll find out more information than they had in the past, because it got rushed, out there. But I was lucky enough to survive on it for 5 years when a new clinical trial came down the road, which was the IL-2 study, and I got randomized to that study. So, I think that we are, as patients, aware that there are a lot of bad things that could happen to us. I may be a different kind of animal, in that now I understand that I am literally a lab rat. And I'm happy to be. Not everybody that comes here is willing to be a lab rat. They want to be cured, and they want to be well, and they want to walk out the doors and never see this place again. I would like to get cured and never see it again as well. But in the meantime, I understand what I'm in for. So, I say, tell me everything,
Can I follow up on that a little bit with pushing you all on how you made, or how you feel about a choice? Because I've heard, I think Ellen said, last resort or desperate, and Richard said that too, and maybe Beatrice said that. But certainly that wasn't the case for Kaimon. It wasn't a last resort. It certainly was a choice. And Richard, I would like to know whether, you said 7 studies, whether there were studies that you've ever turned down, or whether there would, or whether you can imagine a situation that might be offered to you that you would think, I won't do that. Maybe you have that kind of idea, or Beatrice has that kind of idea, and
yeah.
I suppose Kaimon does too. So the question of choice, even in a desperate situation, it sounds like you were made well aware this was your decision. But I'm interested in hearing from you, what might have made you choose the other way?
There, I went upstairs before I came down, and went up to see all my nurses and everybody on the 8th floor clinic before I came down. And I always stop and look in, there's a little box up there that has a list of all of the clinical trials that are now available,
right,
that have to deal with my disease. People that are HIV positive with hepatitis C, everything that's there. And there have been times when I've been asked to look at different studies, see if there's anything in there that might interest me, or I have been offered certain studies and I've said, I don't think that that's the one for me.
Yeah. What was it about them that made you think that?
I think that Probably because of my the time that I've spent here, I have become my own patient advocate, better than anybody else could possibly be. Mm. And don't get me wrong, I always work in conjunction with my PC at home, but I've become my own best patient advocate. And I look at things and I think, well, it probably won't give me the best benefit, or it probably won't give this place the best benefit, mm-hmm. Because of what it entails, or, you know, just things like that. There have been, really crazy, innocuous, I might think crazy, innocuous studies where they just want to do an apheresis all the time and get as many healthy cells and see how long they last. And I've participated in that, and where they've given me markers and see how long the healthy cells last. I've done things like that because I think it's really important. But sometimes there are just some things I look at and I think, if I don't get a good feeling about it, mm-hmm. I don't feel bad about saying no, and they've never made me feel bad about saying no. So, and the reason I signed up, I'll be absolutely honest with you, saying that I understand about being that I'm a human guinea pig here. The final two studies that are linked to my IL-2 study, Icarus and, I can't remember the other one. Anyway, the studies are ending because my understanding is that they're going to present to the FDA the IL-2 as another treatment for HIV. And so those studies are going to be ending here, which to me means that I would be set, they would tell me goodbye. You know, that we don't need you anymore. We've learned as much as we can learn. And I think, well, but I've been coming here for almost 20 years. What do you mean you've learned as much as you can learn? You haven't cured it, so let's find something else. So I found another study and I signed up for it so that I can continue to come here because, I just think that it's that important.
Once I learned that the studies here, you have a mutually beneficial relationship. So the alternative, I always think that instead of staying in the darkness and cursing the darkness, I can turn on light or light a candle. And one thing that I also was very happy about, the notion outside NIH, maybe, I don't know, around the other parts of the country, but in this Washington metro area, if you have sickle cell anemia and you go to the emergency room, most of us do not have insurance because we will not be insured due to pre-existing condition. When you get to an emergency room, there's somebody there with a gunshot wound, and you're sitting there moaning and groaning, oh, I have pain. Nobody will listen to you. And the thing is, some, of course, have done very bad abuse the narcotics. So everybody is thrown into this whole general thing that we are all drug addicts. So when I got here and I see that the doctors, nurses, medical staff, they are willing to listen, they're willing to give a chance, they would not think that anybody who walks through the door or sign up for the program is a drug addict. I was really happy that someone really wants to listen. And another thing that happened also, when we are young, because we are born with this disease, and I understand the doctor said, we even have pain crisis inside the mother's womb. So initially you're given like aspirin, they give you Tylenol, then you have Tylenol with codeine. Before you know, they're giving you Demerol, Percocet, and then you're on morphine. So then they go to the higher doses of morphine. The body, I understand, get used to it. So the more you get, the more you want to have the painkillers. But here, the sickle cell team, they're not only giving pills. They come with a holistic approach that there's mind over matter. So they're working with this pain team where they're using creative ways to help us. So you can have different therapies, hypnosis, acupuncture, like I said initially in the speech that I wrote. That makes you feel that, well, they're trying everything to help me. And I have been very, very grateful to all the doctors and everybody here that have helped me. And I see that if I haven't really come here, I probably died a long time ago. And I'm very grateful, and I'm not sorry that I came, even though the side effects might be very difficult. When they told me I can join the program, I did not hesitate for a minute. I said, please sign me up. That's why I'm here today, and I thank everybody.
One of the risks that were noted for one of the drugs that I was taking was kidney failure. And I said, well, you know, I could live with dialysis. However, they don't have dialysis on top of the ski slope. So I really decided, you know, maybe this drug isn't one that we want to pursue. And we saw, you know, there was a trend. It wasn't up to a danger point yet, but my creatinine level was slowly creeping up. So we had a major discussion then. Okay, should we or should we not? If we stop this drug, does that mean my body will now reject my islets and I'll be back to passing out again? And it was like, well, is there anything else? You know, I was at the same point. Is there anything else? And, you know, my trial, my protocol was supposed to end after 3 years. And I still have islet function. So they wrote an addendum to say, you know what, let's keep studying. Let's see how long those islets are going to last. Because if they dropped me from the protocol, then my insurance would be responsible for buying those $3,000 a month drugs. And they were not real interested in doing that. You know, they wanted me to pursue, still looking at, couldn't they extend it a little? You know, I still had islet function. Was that a possibility? Well, at that point, we as a team decided to switch to CellSap to keep my immune system depressed. And that's been working with minimal side effects. My creatinine goes down almost monthly. So there are risks, and you have to decide, do I continue or do I not?
Carla. First, thanks for being here. You're giving us a very very interesting and useful perspective for us who want to understand research. I have a question. I'm sure you know very well at this point that you can abandon a protocol at any time. Have you ever done it? Have you considered doing it? From what you just said, it seems to me that considerations about health insurance might be relevant if you're entertaining that idea. But it also seems to me, from what you're saying, that you see yourself as part of a team. And I wonder to what extent any of you has considered the possibility of abandoning a protocol for whatever reason, and you have said, no, I'm going to stick because I'm committed to these people, to these researchers. Is that something that has been in your mind? What considerations have you had in mind when thinking about a possibility of quitting?
I'll give you a real quick. When I signed on to the IL-2 protocol, it was in the first stages of that protocol, and we were doing 18 million units of IL-2 a day, which is really nothing compared to what a lot of the cancer patients take, but I think it's more than you would want to take. And it was on IV pump 23 hours a day, 5 days a week in-house, and this was every other month. And we were seeing fantastic bumps in our immune functions. My T-cell counts were skyrocketing, 1,100. Viral load was completely suppressed with the ARVs that I was taking. But it had for me, some major psychological side effects in the very beginning that I was not prepared for. And I had a little incident in-house with a doctor and a nurse while I was in the throes of one of those psychological things, and I thought, you know what? The hell with this. I don't need this. Nothing's worth feeling this bad. And I was ready to chuck it, and I knew that I could walk away from it. And I had a roommate that I always rounded with, luckily. I don't know how it happened, but God bless us. You know, God bless NIH. They always put us together whenever I rounded. And he was able to talk me down from the ledge and talked me into staying. You know, and so I'm still here. But I knew, you know, yeah, I almost walked away from one just because of the side effects that I was feeling from it. And didn't feel like I would suffer any detriment, you know, anything from it. So
anybody else ideas about quitting?
And then we'll get this.
No. Okay. Only one time, because I didn't understand what mental health program they have here entails, because sometimes the disease can really depress you. So when I heard that, well, they can do hypnosis, initially I thought, oh my goodness, you know, you're going to vouch your deep dark secrets. And I asked the doctors, okay, so if you take me back to maybe in the 1600s, I lived before and I was reincarnated, how am I going to get back to this this modern day, you know, here? But then with the help of all the doctors and especially the mental health doctors, the hypnosis doctors, they were so, you know, they treat you like kid, you know, with kid's glove, and explain that, no, wherever you go, we can bring you back. So even if you were the wife of Attila the Hun or somebody, no one is going to hold you responsible because, you know, you're not responsible for that past life if you believe in reincarnation. So that was the only time I was afraid not to get involved. But after I understood what it entails, and now it helps me a lot because when we, the pain crisis attack you, with me, my heart will be beating so fast. And every heartbeat sends pain all over my body. And it will hurt all day, all night, sometimes for days. And when the pain subsides, multiple bilateral joints will swell up and hurt you for longer. That means you're living with pain every day. And with the hypnosis, the doctors have taught me mind over matter. It's like, you know, you can walk through fire if you control your mind, walk through and later realize you just walk through fire. And it has helped me a lot. They gave me some CDs to play. So when you're in pain crisis, you turn on the CD. They provided us with the equipment so we can play this music. It sounds like you're at the beach with birds and the waves. And that kind of relaxes you. So I have really come to enjoy the hypnosis part of the treatment. So I'm glad I'm still here and I didn't leave because of the hypnosis.
That's great. Go ahead.
Oh, I just wanted to say I have a question very similar to what the other young woman asked. I've been involved in clinical research for the last 10 years, and I just kind of wanted to get your input. For NIH patients, do you feel like once you're a patient, you're always a patient? For the islet cell transplant woman, like you mentioned that they told you that you could drop out at any time, but I feel like, and she had mentioned it as well, like if it's $3,000 a month for your insurance to cover it, and your doctor prior to you coming to NIH had no idea why you were passing out in your car, and you're the one who was your advocate, and you came to NIH on your own, and your doctor said, well, sure, go ahead. But you could, quote, drop out at any time, then who would you have gone to see if your doctor didn't know how to help you? And then also for the patients, if it was a randomized controlled trial, well, it sounds like everyone got islet cell transplants, then wouldn't you always have to be on the anti-rejection drugs? So you could, quote, drop out, but then have to see, like, a specialist and that kind of thing.
If I dropped out, and was no longer able to take the drugs because I couldn't afford $3,000 a month, especially if I lost insurance because, surprise, I had a pre-existing condition, I would lose my eyelids. And I would have to try to learn again to be sensitive to when I was having a reaction. My problem was I wasn't aware of that and would just pass out. I could be walking around talking, and I was talking to my son once, and he said, "Mom, you need to have something to eat." And I said, no, I'm fine, because I was very combative. And he said, "Mom, take your blood sugar." I said, "Okay, just because you want me to, I will." And it was 26. I said, "Okay, I guess I'll have something to eat." But I would lose those eyelids that are still working. They're not as strong as they were, and they may not work forever. You know, that's part of the trial, is that they may not, and I will lose the function, and then I'm back to taking full doses of insulin. And I would go to see my endocrinologist again, and I would be back on the pump. You know, so there are some alternatives. It doesn't mean if I wasn't participating in the trial, I would immediately die. It's not a question of death. If I still was hypoglycemic unawareness, yeah, then I might die because I might be in a crash. You know, I was lucky. I was very lucky that didn't happen to me. But once I started, there was no question that I wanted to continue. That never, even though they told me that, the consequences were if I didn't continue, then my eyelids would die. They would reject. So it wasn't a question of life and death for me at that point. Does that answer your question?
It does. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks for asking.
All right. So it is 11:30, so I want to thank you for
Thank you.
Don't forget to turn in your evaluations.
Thank you.